I'm attorney Heather Reynolds, host of Not Alone, a podcast where survivors of sexual harassment or assault share their stories, transform our culture, and inspire one another. Join us for true stories that reclaim our power, support our healing, and remember, you are not alone.
So we're here today with Heather Reynolds, founder of Phoenix Rising Empowerment Project. And so, Heather, what was it that made you want to create this project?
Hi, Brooke. Thank you so much for being the interviewer today. We're switching roles here in a fun way, and I love that we're both founders of this wonderful nonprofit. And the reason that I wanted to create Phoenix Rising was because of the topic of so many experiences in my life and the women around me particularly, is that we all were experiencing similar events, sexual harassment, assault throughout our lives, but we weren't talking about it and we weren't telling our stories to one another. And when we did, we said, really? You too? Me too? We're not alone? And it always blew my mind that we all thought we were the only one. And that we didn't come forward for lots of important reasons. Generally, I think the statistic right now is like 23% of us actually report. And that means that about 99% of all of the incidents that happen, no one is ever held accountable in America, which makes America, American women in particular, 95% of all of the people who experience this in America happen to be women. And 95% of all of the offenders happen to be men, which makes this a gender issue. It doesn't mean that everyone is experiencing it that way, but gender issues and being treated unfairly since I was a little girl because of my gender has been a recurring theme in my life. When I was 7, 8, I would say, well, that's not fair. And I would be told, well, that's just the way it is. And so there was always this little twinge since I was a little girl of, I'm not willing to settle for that. I'm not willing to live into a future where we just accept it because that's the way it is. And the big pivotal moment for me when it really came home for me was when I was 19 and I went to Istanbul, Turkey as a Rotary ambassador for 1 year, an exchange program. It was a scholarship that I had won. And I was really excited because I love other cultures. I didn't know anything about Turkey at the time, and nobody I knew anything about Turkey at the time. I had applied to go to Paris because I'd always taken French and I wanted to go to Paris. You don't get to choose in this program where you end up. And I ended up in Istanbul for a year at the age of 19. Unfortunately for me, nobody let me know ahead of time that I would need self-defense training in order to be able to safely experience that year without daily sexual harassment and assault by strangers on the street. I'm not saying that everyone in Istanbul is a harasser or an offender. Mostly it was men who weren't from Istanbul, who were coming from the smaller villages of Turkey, who had come there for work. And the culture of Istanbul was much more European, much more sophisticated. It would be like being in Paris with a Mediterranean flair, but there were so many men who weren't from Istanbul who were educated more in the eastern side of Turkey that had come there for work, that their culture was that they were very comfortable treating women and me as if we were just toys, as if it was a game, as if it was a power play to remind us who had the power and who didn't. And on a daily basis, I would be groped, grabbed, just walking down the street and catcalled, and guys would sit next to me on a bus or whatever, little shared taxis and things, and they would just touch me and without permission, obviously, and without my wanting it. And I was 19 and a lot of these guys were like 78 and it was not something I was interested in, clearly. And it wasn't somebody I knew. And it was just a daily event. When I first landed in Turkey, my first host family knew that this was a possibility. And they didn't really let me out of the house for the first 6 months, except to just go to school and back. Otherwise, I wasn't allowed to go anywhere by myself. And I didn't understand that as a young woman from America. How could you not let me go to the store or go to the bank or go? It's like I'm trapped inside this house. And it was also funny that even though it's not legal to do this in the Rotary community, they had auctioned me before I arrived to the highest bidding family because they wanted me to teach their daughter English. That's not part of the Rotary program, but in the Rotary of Istanbul at the time, it was fun to auction the exchange student to raise money for the Rotary Club, and the highest bidder would get the exchange student in their home. And I was told upon arriving that it was my job to teach their daughter English, and I wasn't allowed to leave the house except for school for about 6 months. At the time I arrived, my mother's nose had been broken by father, and it was very clear in the household who was in charge and that we were to obey whatever we were told. And so this was the culture in which I landed. After 6 months, I was feeling like I would never see the city of Istanbul. I would never experience the culture except to go to school and back. And that wasn't why I went. I didn't go there to teach English. I didn't go there to not meet the people. So I went to a counselor at my school there and I said, hey, I got a problem. I'm supposed to have at least three families and this family bid for me. So they think they get me for the full year. And that's not the rule. The rule is we get at least three families. And so my counselor at school shook it up and said it's important that she have another family. And she found me another family that would take me. And so I had this wonderful family for the last 6 months who had three daughters and a son. And so I was able to have a really wonderful family experience where I was allowed to leave the house, but I had to always have an escort. And that escort needed to be male. And I don't blame them after seeing what happens if you go anywhere, even with an escort. To walk on a bus and have somebody grab your genitals, and then you turn around to see who it was, and there's seven guys looking straight at you as if they all know what just happened, and you can't tell which one it was. And when that happens in Istanbul, we're trained as women to not say anything, not do anything, try to de-escalate the situation and pretend like it didn't happen. In other words, ignore it. And I did that for the first 9 months. And in those 9 months, I was learning to speak Turkish and I was getting angrier and angrier at being sexually assaulted on a daily basis. Every time I walked out of the house now, it's like, oh, that's why they didn't want me to go out of the house. I see. Even with an escort, I was being sexually assaulted by sleight of the hand, by some guy sitting next to me. It was just, it just gives me chills thinking about it even now. So I got angrier and finally, I'm at the Grand Bazaar, escorted, of course, and this is a huge year old market, probably more than 1,000 years old, and it has probably 1,000 stalls, and it's filled with people, thousands of people, and it's a wonderful place, and I love to go shopping there. But at this point, some guy, he just walks right into me with both hands and stands there. He doesn't even try to run. He doesn't even try to hide. And he's just holding both of my breasts in both of his hands while we're standing there in the middle of the Grand Bazaar. And I was just blown away and I pushed him away with one arm. And by then I had learned a Turkish swear word and I called him a jackass in Turkish. And I was mad, so I yelled it. And this is not something you should do in that culture at that time. And I was trained not to do that, not to react, pretend like it's not happening, but I just couldn't take it anymore. So guess what happened? You could hear a pin drop. This was a bustling, huge market in Turkey where everybody's haggling and everybody's yelling, oh, I'll take it for $3. I'll take it for $4. This is a big bazaar. So all of a sudden you could hear a pin drop. Everyone fell silent and they shamed me. And they did it by making this sound. And they looked right at me. And I'm talking 1,000 people turned to me and shamed me for being the one who spoke the words, who defended myself. And I realized now I'm in more danger than I was before. No wonder I've been taught to not say anything, not do anything. And I had been told that if I get caught doing something improper with a male in that culture in public, if I get kissing a man in public, if I have a boyfriend, if I'm found alone with a man, they will arrest us and they will take us to the police station and they will beat us and they will check me for virginity. And if I'm not a virgin, they will force me to marry him and we will both be arrested and beaten. So that is what I was told at that time about how inappropriate touching or kissing could create a problem, even with someone who might rape one. If one were raped, that same scenario would happen. So you'd have to be forced to marry your rapist. And there's also honor killing. I had a sister at the time who had a boyfriend, and she was worried that if she were ever caught in a terrible situation, like kissing him or something, that those things could happen. And if it went any further than that, her parent or brother would have a duty to kill her. And she never wanted to put them in that position. So even as a beautiful 23-year-old young woman who was the smartest woman I've ever met, she was not allowed to go to work. She was not allowed to go out of the house except to do certain things and often escorted. That was my experience the second half of my stay in Istanbul. And by the time I got home, now I had gone to Istanbul as a total fearless American 19-year-old who wasn't afraid to do anything and certainly wasn't afraid of men and felt very confident. I loved giving speeches. I loved performing in high school. I was a performer. So for me to come home and not want to look a man in the eyes for 2 months, I couldn't look a man in the eyes for 2 months. I was so afraid of that entire enculturation that I had taken on, that it didn't occur to me that I could drive a car when I got home at 19, even though I had been licensed for 3 years. It didn't occur to me that I could vote. That was the first time I was going to be able to vote that November. It didn't occur to me that these would be things that I'd be allowed to do. Even though I'm back in my own culture and I'd only been away for a year and I had been raised for 19 years in the American culture, it only took one to learn to embody or to take into myself so deeply that I was going to be treated a certain way and that I was not of value and that I was not safe. That was how I came home. And so it took me 2 years and a lot of therapy and self-defense training to feel confident again, to feel like I could look a man in the eyes, that it was safe to do the things that I would norm, that all of us in America tend to take for granted. Some of us live in more war zones than others, but I had taken my safety for granted the whole time I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. So it was a big change for me. And I came home really angry. And a lot of self-defense classes are great to get that anger out because I could actually, you know, hit something and I could actually learn to defend myself. And I actually felt really like I got really confident. And I realized that I was the one who could decide how my life was going to go and where I was going to be and who I was going to be there with and what were the safe situations and what were the less safe situations and how do I feel safe in the world? And I realized when I got home for the first time, I had a different set of eyes for my own culture. And I could see the exact same patterns in America for the first time, but just on a really small scale. So what we get away with, what men get away with in Istanbul was up here. What men get away with in America was still happening, but it was a lot less obvious. It had gone underground because it's against the law. Oh, by the way, the law in Istanbul at the time, since 1922, was that women were equal. We don't even have that law in America. We have not passed that constitutional amendment called Women Are Equal still today, but they've had it in Istanbul since 1922, but they don't experience it. So the law is not the answer, was clear to me. It's a cultural change that needs to happen. And a huge change was that I started stepping into my power and started to present myself not as someone that could be easily victimized and that wouldn't fight back and that wouldn't say something. But I started asking the women in Istanbul at the end, what do you do? How do you survive this for a lifetime? And many of them would tell me little secrets, like they carried a hat pin, and they would carry this little hat pin, and the hat pin's this long, and they had it in their hand and it was hidden. And when the guys would touch them, they just poked them with a hat pin. And I never did that, but I could understand why they went around with a weapon that would secretly poke somebody back and make it less likely that they would be victimized again. I don't like the word victim, honestly, and I don't want to use it in the future of the culture that I want to create, which is a culture of safety and respect. And I really want to create a culture where we don't have to worry about these things, where the next generation, my nieces, don't have to worry about these things and don't have to walk around with hat pins or wondering how to defend themselves or wondering what is safe and what isn't safe. My goal is that we live in a culture that takes American culture to the next level. I'm not here to fix Istanbul. I can fix my culture by saying, this is still happening here. This is what it looks like here. This is what we're not talking about here. And as long as we stay silent, and as long as 9 out of 10 women in America don't fight back in those circumstances, which is the statistic I learned 25 years ago when I took that self-defense class, my life changed 180 degrees the moment I learned to defend myself. I'm not talking 5 years of black belt training. I'm talking down and dirty street fighting. My change happened the moment my instructor gave me permission to fight back. And that permission slip was what changed my entire attitude. And all of a sudden I started noticing things in my life where I had been putting up with things, not okay. And I just realized I don't have to do that. I'm allowed to say no. I can go to a bar and not tell some guy my phone number. I'm allowed to lie. I'm allowed to tell someone not my real name. I'm allowed to be safe and not have to take risks just because someone else thinks it's a good idea. I get to choose. And so what it looks like to live in safety and security and dignity and all of that, the permission to do that is a beautiful thing. And so that is why I'm starting Phoenix Rising with you, is to just start to talk about the stories, to not have to carry them by ourselves, to not have to have a story that's a shameful thing that it's happened, to recognize that this is a big pattern, that we're not alone, to recognize that most women in America, over 80%, and almost half of all men, as far as we know, have experienced this kind of sexual harassment or assault in their lifetimes, and oftentimes before they're even 8. It really changes the culture to have to put up with that. And it doesn't need to happen. We can create a culture where men and women treat each other with dignity and respect, and we can honor each other and see what kind of potential is possible for humanity if we're not trying to overpower, dominate, and oppress who appear to be less powerful people in society. And I think when women and children decide that they're not less powerful, especially if we start to share our stories and we start to say it's not okay, and we start to say, I'm not going to put up with that, if we start to fight back, I think we will have a revolution in our society, a cultural revolution. I'm not talking politics. I'm not talking let's pass laws from the top down to try to fix a societal problem. I'm talking grassroots, one by one, we change what we put up with. And the good men start to teach the offenders who've gotten away with it for so long that it's not going to be tolerated anymore. Because I think there are more good men than offenders. And they don't know what's happening because nobody's talking. They're not aware of what's happening. The other women aren't aware of what's happening. And as long as we're silent, nothing will change. So how do we share our stories in a way that doesn't, again, put us in a predicament is a strategic conversation. Phoenix Rising is looking to create a safe place for people to tell their stories that doesn't then put them in a situation where they could be attacked for telling their story. For example, in the Me Too movement, which is a beautiful thing where people broke their silence and started to tell their stories, it actually exposed a lot of women in particular to attack because it was shared in social media without a lot of strategy behind it and without a lot of thought toward how it could be used against us later in a court of law, in our jobs, in our next jobs, in angry people whose names have been named. We saw that play out with the slander and defamation case between Johnny Depp and his wife. And I wouldn't wish that on anyone. I wouldn't wish that on either of them. So to not recreate that would be ideal. How do we share our stories, get the help we need, get the support we need, be able to talk to our families and friends in a way that they can hear us and have our desires and the results we're looking for actually happen? And not assume that the only thing that there is to do is tell authorities and or tell attorneys and judges and assume that they're going to create justice for us. Having been a civil rights attorney after I got back from Istanbul, I thought maybe if I'm a civil rights attorney, then I can put the bad guys in jail. And it's only now as I'm much more mature that I realize, yeah, no, that's not the answer. Putting all the bad guys in jail in a culture that creates them is just going to create a void and a vacuum. And all of a sudden, the factory of offenders that we are in America, the culture creates these offenders and we all create them. So we all play some role in creating this culture and allowing it to continue. I thought that maybe by putting them all in jail, it would solve our problem. It doesn't. And so I didn't want to pretend that it was working, that this thing they call the justice system is about justice at all. It's not. And so now I'm looking at how do we change the culture from a grassroots, one by one, telling our stories, what works for us, what doesn't work for us. How do we do this strategically so that we don't create more harm than good? It's not easy to tell these stories. How do we teach each other to be a good listener like you're doing for me right now? So that was a very long-winded way to share where this came from and where my passion started.
It was really good though. And I think that it's interesting as I listen to your story, I hear similarities from my own story that was still completely different, but has some of those same patterns of healing processes and trying to take my power back, all of those things. And I'm sure we'll get into that another time. But in this podcast, our focus is not alone. And so I wanted to go back to that moment when you realized that you were in trouble. Was there somebody there that helped?
Are you talking about in the bazaar in Istanbul or when I got back?
Yes.
Okay. So in the bazaar, I was escorted, of course. And so I turned to my escort and said, let's get out of here. And we did. We got out as fast as we could to get to a safe place because that kind of energy coming at me by that many people could end up in someone getting stoned. So literally. So I had to get out of there and remember not to go back to that particular spot in Istanbul because that's what can happen.
And then when you got back to America, you said that it was your self-defense instructor that gave you permission. And I find that really interesting because I don't know what your self-defense instructor's story was, but clearly they could see that you needed something and they were able to give that to you.
And she gave it to the whole class. This was an organization called Women Defending Ourselves. And it was empowering each other to feel confident that not only did we have permission to fight back, but we had the skills to fight back. We had techniques to fight back. And it blew my mind to see how much power we all had. And what really gave me a sense of safety was that she said that since 9 out of 10 women in America at that time did not fight back, when offenders are looking for a victim, they will test their potential offendee and they will test her to see if she's the 10% that's going to fight back. And if she is, if she looks back, eye contact, and has that attitude of, you're not going to mess with me, even on a small scale, because the testing is very small scale. The testing is just maybe casually having a conversation with you that feels a little inappropriate, or maybe it's on a bus and they have a slip of the hand on the bus or something. If I'm the 90% that doesn't say anything and doesn't do anything, then I'm an excellent target. Women are being targeted. Children are being targeted. And the offenders are not looking for a fight. They're looking for a victim. So if we can learn to fight back from the very beginning in those little microaggressions, those little situations, we will be communicating with our eye contact, with our body language, with whether or not we give our name and real phone number to some guy in a bar. Like those little things, how we carry ourselves when we walk down the street even, gives the body language, the signals, the answer to the question that that a perpetrator is asking. And that is this a good victim for me? And now that I know that I am not, I communicate that with everything I am. So I'm 100 million times less likely to be targeted because I'm not a good choice. Anybody who attacks me is going to go out as bad as me. It's not going to be pretty because that's a choice I've made. I don't suggest that everybody do that. I'm suggesting everybody be empowered to choose. One of my mentors in this lifetime has been one of my favorite attorneys ever in history has been Mahatma Gandhi and the freedom that he declared for India. And one of the things he said, and I'm going to quote him terribly, but the gist I'll never forget with regard to self-defense, because you remember he was using nonviolence to free an entire country. But on a one-on-one basis, his answer to this question of self-defense was, there's no glory in being a mouse who is eaten by a cat unless that mouse had a choice about it. And that's my goal, is to give women and children more choices. And even little boys who are being bullied. This is the same dynamic. It's a domination. It's a power struggle. It's a dynamic that is about dominating others and harming others. And sometimes it includes sexuality. Sometimes it doesn't, but it's the same domination. So learning how to fight back, learning how to defend ourselves and our boundaries, even if it's just going to see the gynecologist in Larry Nassar situation where you just learn how to say, that doesn't quite sound right to me. I think this is my body. I think it's going to go how I say, Dr. Nassar. Learning how to say that as a teenage girl, learning how to say that as the mother of a teenage girl or the father of a teenage girl, or in my case, when I was 5 years old and the doctor crossed a boundary that I would say no to today, but had no skills at five to defend my boundaries. Those are the cultural things that are so easy to train. How do we say, this is my body and what happens to my body is my decision. Who touches it is my decision. And just having the integrity of that story that, I don't just give my power away to doctors. I don't just give my power away on a date. I don't just give my power away to a lawyer because they say they'll be my champion in court. No, I supervise that lawyer. I decide when and how we go to court or don't, or settle, or whatever the argument's going to be. I'm in control of my life. My life is by invitation only. And my body and the boundaries of my body are by invitation only, and I will defend them. That kind of attitude, I think, would change the world. And sometimes, yes, we give up our lives to have that kind of freedom. And at this point, I've decided that it's worth giving up my life to fight back. I would rather feel the power of my integrity, of my bodily integrity, and my safety than to not say anything and to allow it to continue.
So I wanted to go back to what you were talking about, the not fighting back part of it, and how you had learned that perpetrators are looking for a victim. And wanted to tell you a story that I don't know if I've ever told you before, but so that impacted me. Even as a law enforcement officer, it impacted me. And I was with a bunch of other officers. We were in New Orleans for the Fraternal Order of Police Conference. This was maybe 2 months before Katrina hit New Orleans. And we got there very early in the morning, like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. But the city was still alive. Not everything, but the casinos for sure. And there were still lots of people on the street. And the officers that I was there with, they wanted to go play at the casino for a bit, which held nothing for me. So I was like, I'm just going to go for a walk. No problem going for a walk, female by myself in the middle of New Orleans. So I get on the street and I'm headed down towards the river because that sounds like something interesting to see. And as I'm walking down the street, I start to hear lots of footsteps behind me. Initially, it was just a couple of footsteps. And then it was like, no, there's more footsteps. And then it was like, no, there's a lot of footsteps behind me. And it became clear that they were getting closer and that they were following me. And so you were in my head saying, you have to not be the 90%. You have to show them that you're not the 90%. And so I turned around and in my cop voice, I said, are you following me? And there must have been at least 15 guys.
Wow.
And it shook them for me to turn around and ask this question. And one of them said, no, ma'am, we're not following you. And I said, are you sure? Because it really feels like you're following me. No, ma'am, we wouldn't do that. We were just headed to the mall. Okay, why don't you go ahead then, if you're not following me? And so they did. All 15 of them just went ahead of me and nothing happened. And I was able to walk to the river and see the river. And I walked through the mall and I had a nice walk and came back to the casino and nothing happened. And that's not to say that something would have happened, but it sure felt like it would have had I not been intentional about being that 10% that showed you were going to get a fight out of me. And that came from you, which came from your self-defense instructor. And so I think I wanted to point that out because, again, the purpose of this podcast is that we are not alone. And sometimes it's in those little moments that we're telling each other a story or we're letting each other know this is what happened or this is a statistic I've been told or this is how I overcame. Those little moments, we never know how impactful they are.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that story. This is a great example of how if we were to share our stories with each other, the stories of how we stayed safe, the inspiring stories of survivors, it's just so empowering to others that we learned how to be safe. Just thrilled that made a difference in your life. And that at that moment that you remembered that little piece of what do I do? And it's incredible that you weren't even in the class and you were able to use that. Now that I recall back to the class, I think the most powerful thing I was taught was to use my voice. And by using my voice and my body language, my voice and my body language, to confront that testing period, to just communicate who's going to control this. I think that is the most powerful thing I learned, because if I can control the situation with my voice and my body language, like you did with 15 people behind you, following you, maybe it's incredible that the voice and the body language and the attitude is enough. And I would probably wager that it's enough 99% of the time, because there are plenty of other people who don't have that training. You were a police officer at the time. You weren't.
I was, and my natural instinct was to keep walking and to get further away. And I really had to fight my natural instinct of just be quiet, just don't say anything, just let them walk by you. And I didn't, because I had you in my head saying, no, turn around and confront them.
Amazing. I'm remembering, oh my gosh, what would you do with 15 attackers? And in the self-defense training, you actually learn how to take on multiple attackers at the same time. And in my mind at that moment, if they hadn't responded well, and if I were in your shoes, if they hadn't responded well to that very direct question and the eye contact and the body language and the attitude, I would have known how to take them on because I've been trained to do it. It's just without a weapon. My body is my best weapon. And to begin with, I should never have to use it if I use my voice and my body language. Obviously, I have no control over their response. Who knows? They might be on drugs. Who knows? But I would be ready for that. Like, it doesn't scare me anymore to have 15 guys right behind me. I can turn around and not just take them on with my voice and my body, or I should say my body language, but like you as a police officer, you've been trained to fight. You actually know what to do to defend yourself. And I think having that extra knowledge of what to do if this does escalate actually makes that voice and that body language a lot more solid. It's not just a bluff. We would fight.
Yeah, I think we would. And I think it is important to be genuine and to be able to back that up with almost like a pre-decision, right? Pre-deciding that should something happen, I'm going to fight.
Thank you for that. And having said that, I have a little fear in my mind that women who chose not to fight because they've been told by society that they will be safer, they're more likely to survive in the long run if they don't fight. And even though that is not true, that is the underlying story that I was taught since I was a little girl, even though it's not true, it's a myth statistically. But I didn't know that until I was 24, taking a self-defense class from somebody who knew the real statistics and knew that I would be safer if I were willing to fight back. And now I know that the fight never even has to happen because I know how to use my voice and my body language to say, yeah, I'm not a good victim. Don't pick me because this is not going to be pretty. And so that attitude does most of the work for me. And like in your case, you never had to address whether there was going to be a physical altercation. That is such a great story, Brooke. Thank you so much. I never heard that story from you before this moment. And we've been talking about this for over a year. Just goes to show, and not everybody on the show knows that you and I are sisters and that we got together on this one because we were both passionate about changing this story in our society.
I think that passion comes from a lot of different places. But in closing, I want to go over some of the things that we want to emphasize. And one was that obviously we're not alone. We had each other and we had instructors and teachers along the way. And that's helpful and it's empowering. And the other thing that really hit me was your voice, that we have a voice. And I think to some degree, women especially are socialized to just be quiet and not say anything and just go with the flow. And I think it is important to know that we have a voice.
Yes.
And to know that we're not alone.
Yes. And I guess what I was trying to honor is that women who choose to not tell their story and not have a voice, I really want to honor that choice. And that they're not alone either. There's 77% of Americans who choose not to say anything. And I don't think that's wrong. I think that is totally appropriate given the circumstances and the price that so many people pay when they actually say something, when they actually tell their story, when they actually report. I think there's a reason 77% of us don't tell our stories. And I really want to honor that choice and not make it wrong. Create a society in which our voices can be heard and strategically learn how to use our voices in a way that doesn't come back to bite us. In a society that wants to blame us for the event. So I'm excited about changing the story of that in our society of who, maybe we should just stop blaming and say, what's not working here? And how do we reinvent the relationships? Since most of these attacks are not strangers, like I experienced in Istanbul, These are actual family members, friends, people we trust, our doctors, our those kinds of people we know. 80 some percent of our offenders are targeting people they know, and to know how to have a voice within that relationship context is not easy to do. And I just, here I am 52, finally finding my voice for not just me now, but how do I have a voice that can be strong enough to inspire others to also have a voice and remind ourselves that we're not alone.
Thank you for that, Heather. And thank you for sharing your story with us today.
And thank you for yours. That was a fun surprise. I'm so happy to hear that sharing our stories actually makes a difference. Actually had one more tool in your toolkit at that moment that you could be safe. And if all we did was that one experience, that would be a success. That would be enough. So may this bless others. May their stories bless us. And may we all evolve together to create a safer society for everyone. Thanks for hosting, Brooke. It was really fun.
Absolutely. Your turn next time.
Okay. Talk to you later. Thanks for listening. This podcast is brought to you by the Phoenix Rising Empowerment Project, a nonprofit created to end sexual violence. Please visit prep.support for more information or to make a donation. You can also receive support and share your story at prep.support.